Hello, welcome back to Q&A, the Kaddish Gallery podcast series from St. Ambrose University. I'm Chris Reno. Recently, we had the pleasure to sit down with Jill Wells in the gallery to discuss her current exhibition, Dark Sensory Spaces. It's on view in both the Kaddish and Morrissey galleries, so if you have a chance in the next week to stop by and see it, I highly recommend it. Please enjoy this conversation with Jill Wells.
I think the first question that came to mind to me was, yeah, the mural artist and out of this, that's a pretty big jump, and it happened pretty quickly. I mean, you had an arts training, and I think when I first saw your name, I saw it associated with some murals outside. So maybe would you mind talking a little bit about how that evolution happened? Was it rapid? Was it slow?
It was really slow, honestly. I did my first mural in 1999, and is that picking up?
That's good. Yeah, it's good.
And I had gone to DMAC, which is Des Moines Area Community College, and after 2 years, I wanted to transition, and they didn't offer an art degree that I was looking for, and so that's why I ended up at Drake. And so I had done a mural at a location called Creative Visions in Des Moines, and then I used that, and that was the first mural I'd ever done, and probably the highest wage I'd ever been paid. So it was really interesting that the owner, took a risk with me, which gave me a lot of encouragement to continue going, I think, later on in my career with murals. But then I used that to get a small scholarship to go to Drake. And I think that also helped me feel confident, like, oh, I must be doing something right in this pursuit of this type of work when it comes to art as a potential career.
So you had a community college training. Enough to get you out there to make a mural, apply for and receive a stipend to make a mural.
Yes.
And then you use that mural as your application when you applied for Drake to get a scholarship there?
Yes.
Okay, so in each of those steps, you were getting confirmation that you were doing something good.
Absolutely.
In the visual arts. And for you, early on, you thought, mural's where it's at. Like, that's the thing I want to do, right?
It was. Yeah. I fell in love with murals right away. I think one from the scale, but the community engagement was unlike anything I'd ever experienced, because before that, I literally was in a studio. There might have been a couple other people there. It wasn't people coming in and out of the space. There wasn't the sounds of what was going on there. They had dancers there. They had a drum line there. You know what I mean? So I was kind of spoiled. I didn't have to put on any like headphones. I got free music. And just the energy of, you know, the public space. I was like, oh, this is it. So I knew I wanted to continue, but I didn't do my second mural, honestly, until I graduated in 2005.
From Drake?
Yeah.
With the degree in?
In fine arts. In painting
fine arts.
As my major. And then art history was my minor.
Okay, so you mentioned that the romantic ideal of the painter in the studio, and now you're saying, like, but that the public aspect was really exciting, so... At Drake, the work you made in Drake, if it wasn't murals, was it still public facing? Was it still more kind of just making easel paintings?
It was.
It was, yeah.
It was no public facing work. There was no, I think probably the closest I had done an internship at a place called Art 316. And so I ran the gallery space there, got credit, and the community came and went, but it was similar to almost like Mainframe, which I mentioned earlier. And so above this, the gallery were these studios. And so I interacted with some of the individuals and kind of met some of their clients. So it was a little bit of an interesting mix of being engaged with the community, learning how to run and curate shows, learning how to promote shows. So it was definitely out of the studio space and away from my easel. But what happened was, is it made me think about my easel work differently because I saw what happened, you know, in other people's careers. And I also saw how it translated into the world outside of the studio. You know? So that was really, really beneficial in a way that I didn't think. I was like, I just want credit, you know, for this class.
Yeah. So graduating, then you continue to try to make murals, or you went into other fields?
I taught at an after-school arts program called ASAP, which is still in Des Moines. And then I did my second mural at Blank Park Zoo. And then I did that for quite some time, just working, teaching. And then that was probably between 2005 and then in 2012 is actually when I became a certified alcohol and substance use counselor. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it was a lot of teaching. There were some other public works in there, but there was no mindset on how to actually like create any type of business plan or model to create a practice that was sustainable. Mm-hmm. I had no experience. I didn't take any business classes at trade to understand how that was a part of being an artist. Mm-hmm. And I potentially could have. Mm-hmm. But I think that sometimes it's oddly still kind of foreign to the degree field for artists. Oh,
I mean, I was a little before you, but in 98, certainly no one was encouraging me to take any kind of business plan seriously other than to go to grad school. That was the only business plan for an artist at my school, was go to grad school.
Yeah.
Or, you know, apply for residencies. Yeah, that was it. That's the sum total. Yeah. Go out for a residency. But, you know, what else? Like, how do you make it work if you're not rich? Like, I don't know.
Oh,
it wasn't there. I think the climate has definitely shifted in the realm of college level academia for how to better prepare yourself to do something with it. Mm-hmm. And maybe that was inevitable with social media because it is so much more approachable and democratic. For all the ills of social media, it's far more democratic now to easily get a business off the ground. I mean,
absolutely.
You need very little to get an arts business off the ground and potentially be successful with it. But okay, so then it was not until the COVID era that you decided to put aside this other career and mm-hmm. become the full-fledged artist again.
Yeah.
And was that just like YOLO? Hyper YOLO?
It kind of was. Yeah. You only live once, honestly. Mm-hmm. I, to this day, miss counseling. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I love being a substance use counselor. I was like, this is it, this is what I'm doing. And I was able to do art in counseling. So mm-hmm. I'm not an art therapist. However, I was able to use my background and I knew just enough mm-hmm. to be able to walk through certain exercises and to be able to read mm-hmm. the responses from those mm-hmm. and then integrate them into kind of extrapolating some of the nonverbal and placing it into a conversation in a one-on-one.
Wow.
So I really loved that. It was, you know, this...
What kind of art? Just drawing?
Yeah. So we would do... there's a really great exercise called the Lighthouse Exercise. Mm. And then there's another one of my favorites called either Past or Present Hands or What Do My Hands Hold? And so the Lighthouse Exercise is one where you give kind of very minimal information, but it's like... You ask someone to draw this lighthouse, and there's a couple other things that you can say, you know, to include, but then you can say, maybe I only want to ask them to include two of these things and not like the five from the exercise. Mm-hmm. And then you look at, you know, what's in the lighthouse? Are they inside the lighthouse? Are they outside the lighthouse? Are they in the water around the lighthouse? Is there water around the lighthouse? How much? Is there a boat? Are they in the boat? Are they out of the boat? Are there oars in the boat? So there's mm-hmm. all these ways to kind of psychoanalyze mm-hmm. that. And then the same thing with like what my hands hold. If you are struggling with the past or the present, which often comes up with just how our minds work. And if you think about something like anxiety, oftentimes one of the telltale signs or the thing that someone is struggling with is they're in the future too often. And so mm. you can look at the future hand and you can see what's drawn in the future hand. Mm. And then you look at the past one and you can look at things like, you know, remorse, depression, or other things unfulfilled, you know, something didn't get finished. So you see what's in that hand. And then so you start to kind of pull and you ask questions about them, not saying, I see this. You just ask, well, tell me more about this, or I see this and what is this? And then next thing you know, whoever you're working with has walked themselves through their thing. Mm-hmm. they're centered in that experience instead of you telling them.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved that career because I felt like it was so meaningful. And so I worked 5 years in residential and then 3 years in outpatient residential. I worked with adults, and it was very, very cute. They'd be going through withdrawals oftentimes. So you see, saw a lot of stages of change. And then you'd be with them when they leave and get ready to go home. So it was really special. You'd be with them during holidays,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was really special too. And then when I switched to outpatient, I know, right? They're not with their family on Christmas, you know, so you get to create this environment, you know, and we're giving gifts and, you know, this is wonderful. And then when I did outpatient, I was working with youth who were court ordered to treatment. So I got an experience of working with the justice system that was very different. And I mean, it's to try to help a 14-year-old get through the justice system. Like, I felt so bad. I felt so, you know, they're trying to get through school, trying to fit in, figure themselves out. And now, so.
Yeah.
Eventually, you get to the pandemic, you're not face to face anymore, and you're kind of watching this horror movie on a screen, right? Mm-hmm. You're watching your client like fall apart, and there's nothing that you can do because you're not in the same room with them, and that makes a difference.
Yeah.
Telehealth services is amazing. However, there's a real power of being person to person, and I think we all experienced that from the pandemic when we were separated from people.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to a point where it's like I got so depressed from it, and I couldn't. I felt powerless to help. And then I just remember that ticking number on the screen of like how many people we had lost every day, getting higher and higher. And I started looking at my own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I don't want, regret is like a huge driving force in my life. I make a lot of assessments on where I want to go based off of how much regret would be associated with the choice I make.
The regret factor.
And so I was like, I don't want to live with that regret of not pursuing it. I said, if it doesn't work out, I can always come back to counseling.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, how do I combine these things? And that's where the mentorship program came from. I thought I can run a practice and figure out my career, whether that's public arts or studio practice or both, but I don't want to give up working with people. And so how do I do that? And that's where the mentorship program, so those two kind of came together.
And so in this era, you really haven't made murals at all.
Oh,
you know, they're the more interactive ones like we saw here, but the mural has transformed, really.
Yeah, it's transformed. So this year was the first year that I integrated touch into the actual murals.
Okay.
And so the partnership with the individuals that I worked with was a key to that because I think it is also still like, what's the point of that?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're working with someone who understands what the point of that is, and the space was a really great space to start with because it's early education, it's elementary, and the tactile world is so much a part of their everyday activities. So it was a great starting piece. And then and talks about, like, there's this evidence. What can we pull as far as, like, are there some common threads of data points that we can put into future works, but in other spaces, whether it's workspaces, universities, things like that. What would the point of a tactile mural be in other spaces?
Yeah, I was really glad I saw that today because I'm thinking about the difference for you with work that's accessible and open to all and inviting and engaging senses in different ways. But then there's work that's actually about this idea of accessibility. Like, this work in here is really about accessibility as much as it's accessible as well. So did that evolve, like the idea that the subject matter itself became like what did you call it? The Braille, the ADA, the whole ADA bill is actually the subject matter of the work? How did you make that leap to that next step where it actually, it's not just that the work itself is accessible, but you're actually making work about accessibility?
I think that came through trial and error.
Okay.
So I started them very traditionally. I got a copy of the ADA from the Braille bookstore online. It's maybe like $30.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the pandemic, so I'm just working my way through each page.
Mm.
And they're oil on the surface. So again, this traditional material that I'm very comfortable with,
mm-hmm.
but on a surface that is foreign to me.
Mm.
I had not worked with Braille before that. And paper wasn't really a big part of my practice. It was usually canvas or a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is when I started saturating them, I noticed that unless you're pushing really, really hard, the oil doesn't get into the, if it's a double-sided, there's that convex and that concave, so
mm-hmm.
it doesn't get into the dip. And so you have these really tiny negative spaces of white.
Mm-hmm.
And so I liked that it started for me, I started thinking about like light and like the retina and like this tiny little hole where light comes through. And then I started thinking about stars and how from a distance they looked like these tiny little dots of light.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I like that. I'm going to leave that. And then but that happens by trial and error. This happens by experiment, by accident. And
mm-hmm.
then I'm like, well, so what else could happen if I just experiment more?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that. I started thinking, what do I do different with the paper, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where kind of these slits come in. And I started looking at other educational tools connected to blindness. And so one of those are light boxes. They're great educational tools because the contrast of the light and the dark helps the eye focus. And so I thought, well, can I turn these into light boxes? And if so, how do I do that?
Mm.
And then started creating these. So each time it's like they're transforming over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how these came to be. But then when I thought about accessibility and inaccessibility, I thought, well, you can't necessarily access all the text because you have these splices through it.
Mm-hmm.
And for somebody who doesn't read Braille, you need someone to translate it for you. So it's inaccessible for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's putting first a population that often feels like they're put like third, fourth, fifth, right? It was to the disability community, not putting me first.
Mm.
We need to be focused on them first if we want to gain access to what the text in itself says.
Yeah, that's wild, yeah. Yeah, it's like we normally think of the sighted as the dominant mode of experiencing these objects, and then someone who may have a Braille description or can actually feel the object or like this fascinating new 3D. I love the idea of having 3D models of my paintings. Like that
right.
would just be insane. I'm really excited about that notion, but all of those are still considered the secondary experiences of that object.
Mm-hmm.
And here these objects are perhaps a primary experience for folks who, you know, are working through these different disabilities, and then we are having the secondary or other experience,
yeah.
and we couldn't have that primary without their help. That's really it's really a great flip of this whole idea. I was thinking in your talk earlier again about, well, I think it was Mike's question, how do we make this change?
Yeah,
you know?
That's going to stick with me.
Yeah.
Because yeah. there's a lot to that.
There's a lot to it. And, you know, for me, the thought was, well, I wouldn't have even thought of inviting you in all truth. I would never have thought of inviting you to show here if someone on campus hadn't said to me last year, well, two things. Someone on campus, a staff member said, I can't read your labels. And the more I see I can't read your labels, they're too small, I can't read them. Can you make some changes to your labeling so that the information is more accessible? And I was like, oh, of course, because I'm always like making these very subtle labels or quiet, or it's just vinyl. It's like gray on gray. It's like I want to keep everything very
right?
like subdued so you just have that primary experience of the work, right? She can't see the labels. She can't get the information she needs to have the experience that she's going to have of the work. So that really struck me. And now, did I follow up on that? Sometimes, yes and no. Like, it's like the mode has slowly had to change for me, right? I got to do these labels, but I put it off till it's too late. I don't do a very good job. We did a little bit with QR codes with the thing over with St. Ambrose objects over in Rogo. So we're starting to get some audio descriptions for things. But then, you know, we have some students with accessibility issues here, and we made a lot of changes in the department to make the experiences here more inclusive and better for everyone. And not that we're there yet, but we made a lot of changes. And it wasn't until, again, someone was asking for it. Like, I can't get into this house to have this class. It's not going to work for me. What are you going to do so that I can, because I'm a student here as well. What are you going to do so that this works? I don't know. We got to figure it out, like, right away. We got to figure it out, like, in a couple days. And so you just don't, we walk around all day not thinking about it. You just don't have to, I don't have to think about it. I don't think about it. And so I like to hear that you also, it's been an evolution for you because we're evolving. And to hear those statistics about the number of people coming up, it's going to be, it's not going to go away. Each one of us has a different sensory experience, and we should start thinking a little bit more respectfully about everyone's sensory experiences here, right? So, did I ask a question? I don't think I did.
I'm listening to what you're saying, but I think, right, we all have those, we're one person, the people that are in our lives, you know, and then the people that are in their lives that kind of come and go, who are, mm-hmm. you know, they're going to share stuff from time to time, and then I think that sharing sometimes is asking, so it might not be a direct ask, and then we get to make a decision what we want to do about that.
Right.
And sometimes people intentionally make those decisions not to do something about it, and sometimes, again, it's an unintentional thing.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's always a promising opportunity, even though they choose, maybe for whatever reason, they aren't able to or can't or whatever, do something that doesn't exclude me from making an alternate decision about
right,
it.
Right, right. Well, so along that lines, I thought maybe we could do a quick audio description of the show for the podcast. So where are we at here? How would you describe the experience of walking into the show?
So usually in audio descriptions, I try to keep them relatively short.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually start with, are we interior or exterior? Because if it's a photograph, you might not necessarily even be able to tell that. But I also think that it's something that lends to what comes next.
Mm.
So if you're not used to doing one of those, then it gives you a little bit of guidance. So you're in an interior space. You've got four walls.
Mm.
The room is lit with blue LED lights. After that, you can change the lights, which is in this description. You have the choice how you want to experience it. You can change the lights. And then you can tell them, well, how do you do that? So when you enter into the gallery, to your right is a podium or a table or whatever that might be. And on that thing is XYZ. Mm-hmm. To your left is another podium. On that thing is XYZ.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can go wall by wall. You can say there's five works of art on the wall to your left. There's three works of art in the wall in front of you. And there's five works of art on the wall to your right.
Mm-hmm.
At the wall behind you, there's three works of art.
Mm-hmm.
And you can leave it like that. You can go into a whole slew of description. I mean, you can go kind of down a rabbit hole with it.
You stay very literal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could go further and talk more about subject matter or meaning or whatever if you wanted. But it's really just about getting the literal description first and foremost so that picture can be made in your mind, I guess, of what's happening in there.
Yep.
Yeah. But, sure.
Yeah.
When I first walked in the room, I liked it immediately. Mm-hmm. I liked just the feel. It was right out there, and suddenly very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out, okay, how do I orient myself here? And I usually turn left when I walk into a room.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but I do. And I come across these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I then shift to this wall, and they are cool and brighter.
Mm.
And then I shift here, and they're like really bright. Is that a deliberate decision on your part, or on the curator's part, to kind of move from a darkness to a brightness? Or conversely, if you came in and went bright, to move from bright to dark, was that there, or is that just...
That's a great question, and I really appreciate that observation. These are, I just turned them up just now. To preserve the battery, actually, they're usually lower. So I just tell you that so you know, like in the future, if you come in, you can turn those down. You know what I mean? Like you can. These, they're always going to be like that. My first desire with the space is what you had pointed out. I wanted an experience in a gallery, especially, that wasn't jarring with the lights. Most, and I understand the power of lighting, truly. I personally feel better in a dimly lit room. And so I started to wonder, how is that for other people? And especially in a traditional space where you don't have, or in a space in a gallery where traditionally that's not the experience. It's usually the overhead lights, and that's how you feel and you experience the space. So I like that your first experience is like it kind of, you know, it's soothing, right? That was one of my primary goals with lighting. It wasn't necessarily like dark to lighter to lightest and then back again. And sometimes I wonder if something's happened just from subconscious. I don't know how to really tap into that the best, but I have had some kind of moments like that in my life where I'm like, oh my God. And it worked out so perfectly that my only conclusion was like, that's my subconscious. Like literally, I was like, wow, that's wildly, you know, strong. And it just did it on its own.
Oh yeah. Every painting I've ever made is that. Luck and stumbling upon and like, oh yeah, okay. Hopefully, yeah. And well, and then also the show is really, the remote controls are there for you to make these adjustments yourself too, so you can change them to create a narrative like that, or to just bring everything down to a dim, or change all the colors. So, yeah. So there's a lot of different ways in which you can make this room work for you.
And that's one thing that so Daniel Van Sant, you might hear me talk about him a lot, but that's one thing we talk about at the Harkin Institute all the time is choices, like the power of choices. Is a big part, I think, of inclusion and accessibility, right? If I'm giving you one choice, that's my choice. Potentially, that could be one's argument for that. And then the other one is, well, I just didn't know any better. I mean, and then there could be everything else that's kind of in between. But I think when you give choices, like what type of seat fits your body the best, you know, instead of here's this one seat, right? What color suits you best in the room? Do I want these green? Do I want them pink? I get the choice. Do I touch the work? Do I not touch the work? I get the choice. Do I want sound? How much sound? What kind of sound? No sound. So I wondered, how can I give those choices in this exhibit as well that would respond to what I'm hearing a lot of people saying? So that was something I'm really happy we got to do.
Yeah, no, it's turned out well. I'm surprised Ray did put on the headphones to cancel out my voice in here in this room.
Can I ask you a question, gentlemen? With the right behind you, sir. I'm so sorry. Can you hear okay?
Not really.
Do you want to come? Do you want to come up?
We're a little quiet back up here.
I'm starting to lose my voice, so I was trying to project, but I'm like, it's not going. I saw this.
Were you cupping it back there?
I saw the ear cup, so I wanted to make sure.
Yes. It's really blowing over there. Yeah. What else? There's something else I wanted to ask you about. I don't want to lose it. Does anyone else have any questions while I'm trying to recall the question I had? Rachel, go ahead.
A little bit. I guess it's maybe just kind of like an idea, too. Like, would you have the background? And asking the question of even to other people, like in a room, what is it you like or don't like?
Yeah.
Specifically, it was the worst part of going to spaces, you know, to make it more comfortable.
Now, that's a really great question. And the blue light spectrum, one of the things I had read about it was it is soothing. And they specifically, one of the reports I read or remember said dementia and PTSD were two of the primary ones that says that it aided and for you to be able to experience the environment in a way that is soothing, relaxing, rather non-triggering. So I know for everyone it might be a little bit different, but that's one of the reasons why I went with the blue. And those questions, I think that, oh gosh, there's so many ways it could be incorporated even into your work. So when you are asking about the things that we can do, that would be a way that if you, you know, not to like put the question back on you, right, I'd even love to collaborate with you on something like that. And what that would look like, I'm not sure, but I think it could respond to something that you already know, some of your lived experience, but through, you know, a really graceful something, it wouldn't be like asking a question that's disrespectful or putting anyone into, you know, a situation that's like violating their rights to become aware of that. You're creating from a place of, I know something about this. So the work that you would be creating would be providing for that. And it's just like, then it connects with that person. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, mental health is something right now that is on the forefront of a lot of conversations, and PTSD being one of those. It's like, and what people would call a maybe invisible or hidden, something that you don't necessarily see when it comes to disability. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so I think that the space for that is wide open, and being embraced in a way that doesn't have necessarily the stigma that it used to. Like, my mom's been in mental health her whole life. And I remember, you know, how she used to talk about what she'd experienced, you know, 20 years ago, and how different it is now, because people are valuing that this is a real thing, even though we've all had minds our whole lives. Like, it's right. Just, it always is. And I think that some of that is associated to the history of how mental health was managed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It, right?
If you acknowledged a mental health issue, you would go away.
Yeah, right? So, like, let's not talk
away.
About it.
Also, too, there's another thing I was going to ask. The cards that you had in the thing for the different languages, is that something that's expensive that you could, or now that we could all do in galleries for just if somebody came in to have one on hand?
Yeah. They're called Yodo Minis. I love these things. There's tiny little cute little boxes. I know. It's like $100, but it's like an all kit and caboodle, right? You get the headphones, you get this little bag that you can tote the headphones around with. And then you get the sound box, and then a set of cards, and you can pick what cards will go with your starter set. After that, if you wanted like additional ones, then it's like really inexpensive, like $4.99 for like a set of two or three. French, Spanish, English, like tons of different languages. And so it kind of, I think, could provide for, if you're growing out this part of the gallery, it could be like a sensory bag that a lot of the museums and galleries are doing. Like, there's a part of your sensory bag that you get to take around the space with you. And it connects to your Wi-Fi. And then instead of words, they're pictures. So if you're struggling with literacy, there's not a word that tells you what's going on. There's a picture that tells you what's going on as you click through it.
Okay. Yeah, look into that for sure.
I love these things.
Yeah. For sure. Very good.
So, I'm in the art industry, and I work with more trying to like incorporate the language, but we only have two right now. But a lot of the museums around here are trying to get more than DEI.
Great question. That's a great question. That's exactly what I was going to ask about. That's what I was trying to remember to ask about was, I just want to re-say it because I don't think Ray picks up on it from that far on the microphone. So Ray's asking about DEI and accessibility. And I know that some of your other shows maybe deal a little bit more with identity and accessibility. And so, yeah, what could you say for the podcast in terms of that intersectionality?
So for traditional spaces like galleries or museums that are looking to incorporate DEI, one of the things that I was thinking about with my work is if there's too many barriers to do some of these things right away, could I create a body of work that does everything for them? Right? So if I have my own Braille labels, if I have my own QR codes, if I already did my audio description, if I've already tried to secure everything so where it's safe, and we have a conversation about like what's your insurance, and anything else that might go with it, do I have a team that I'm bringing with me? What's your barrier then to say no? Right, because I've taken all those out of the equipment. That's what I was hoping to do with some of this stuff, or some of these works, some of these exhibits, is can I bring an all-in-one package and pitch that to you and see if that would open up the opportunity for it to happen then again? Or would it open up the conversation for you and your board members to say, oh, well, we could do QR codes and start there, because we've had these conversations, we see that it works, we see how many times it's being clicked. You know, so it's something like that. That was my hope behind kind of doing all of this. Because I'd had some people ask me, like, it was probably like one or two people, like, how often is this going to be used? You know, basically, like, how many individuals?
Museum professionals or gallery professionals ask you that.
Yeah. Like, how often is someone going to read the Braille, basically?
Is it worth the effort?
Is it? And that goes back to kind of the mindset.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, you know, so that's another conversation that's had a lot within my conversations with the Harkin Institute and the disability community, is that oftentimes you're going to avoid the thing that you don't feel like is doing anything for you. So if you don't have an audience of XYZ, maybe you should look at, did I create the space for the audience, like you're saying, right? And so sometimes I'm like, if people ask those questions, I think they're asking the wrong question. Right. I think the better question would be, how have we unintentionally
excluded,
or how have we unintentionally created a environment that doesn't, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, because it's really sad to hear that. You know what I mean? And like to this day, there's environments when I'm with my brother, I'm like, we're not going. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a hazard for one if he falls, or like, we can't go there, mm-hmm. but we want to go there.
Great questions. Okay, well, I mean, I think we're nearing our time. Any other questions from anyone? No? Jill, thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you. Yeah. This has been great for me as well.
This has been Q&A from the Kadich and Morrissey Galleries at St. Ambrose University. We hope you've enjoyed this program. All rights reserved, 2023.